context.
Again, these are issues that we've encountered already during the course, the issues of context during learning. So going back even into classical conditioning, when we talked about the studies with rats on a hot plate in the injection room. Okay, so context cues, environmental specific stimuli. And talking about this in terms as well of operant conditioning, talking about stimulus control. Learning does not exist in a vacuum. Learning exists in some sort of particular context. There will be different stimuli that are going to be present around the learner at the time which the learner is learning. All right. Now, the interesting thing with this is these stimuli, even if they're not actively, you know, the subject, the learner isn't actively going, oh yeah, I really got to remember these stimuli all around me, they actually can serve as a cue to evoke particular behavior. Okay, so context-specific cues essentially prime or prompt certain types of behavior. If the stimuli, these environmental stimuli are absent, and the subject does not seem to be recalling the appropriate behavior, this may be a case of what's called cue-dependent forgetting. And maybe they've just forgotten. You know, it wouldn't matter whether the cues are present or not, but if you bring the cues back and the subject can remember, but you take these environmental cues away and they forget, this is called cue-dependent learning. So again, this comes back to stimulus control. In the presence of these stimuli, what do you need to do? The stimuli essentially act as a prompt or a cue, saying, what am I doing here? What has to happen? Now, some of this, you know, you get some interesting ones here where you say, well, that shouldn't really work, does it? Yeah. Example from Perkins and Wyant, 1958. They trained two groups of rats in two mazes. One maze was painted black, one maze was painted white. Otherwise, exactly the same maze. Okay? Rats go through, do their run. 1 minute retention interval. Not a long retention interval at all. Take half of the group that was trained in the black maze, half that group, after the retention interval, runs the black maze. The other half runs the maze that's been painted white. Half of the group that ran, that was trained in the white maze, runs the white maze. Half of them run through the black maze. Okay? So half go through the original, half switch. The rats that switched to the opposite color maze sucked. They did terribly at it. It was exactly the same maze, the same turns, the same path. The only difference was it was a different color. And the rats are all like, whoa, I've never been here before. What's going on? They treated it, that's literally it. They've never been there. It's like, oh, I've got to learn a whole new maze. Dude, it's just a different color maze. But apparently, for however the rat brain works, it's the color that says, yeah, I'm in this maze. It's black. Or I'm in this maze. It's white. Whoa, I'm in a different colored maze. That can't be the same thing that I just learned, even though the path looks to be kind of the same. All right? So, I mean, you know, I'm not suggesting that humans are quite as susceptible to something like that, just changing the color around a little bit. Well, maybe. You get into some very interesting things with this. So, in fact, environmental psychologists know this. Subtle changes in, say, like the color of a building or office space can lead to differences. Behavioral psychologists that are working in therapy know this. If you've got individuals where, oh, they've developed a phobia or aversion or something aversive happened in, let's just hypothesize here or make up a story. Let's just say something aversive happened in a particular room in the house, and now the person's reluctant to go into this room. So, you know, the office, they've got their home office, and they get some horrible, horrible news through email there, you know, whatever it happens to be, and now You know, they're very reluctant to go and work in their office space. That's having problems, causing difficulties at work. And, you know, it could be something as simple as, like, okay, we're gonna change the room around. We're gonna repaint it. We're gonna get new furniture. We're gonna set your desk up in a different part of the room. In some cases, actually, just making that change breaks the association. Yeah. Well, there becomes a question. Are we purposefully remembering the context cues at some level? Probably not in the sense that it's a conscious memory of things, but they do seem to get encoded somewhere in there. Our brains are very good at pattern recognition, whether the pattern's real or not. And so we encode a huge amount of stuff. What's relevant, what isn't, that becomes a different issue. But most people are probably not going, oh yeah, the room was in autumn, it was an autumn gold paint when I got the horrible news on email about yada, yada, yada. It's the autumn gold. The autumn gold makes me feel bad. Probably not. They probably can't articulate that. Some people might. Some people that are particularly, you know, introspective or have gone through a psychology course may make those sorts of connections, but the vast majority of people probably don't. In the same way that for example, when we talk about stimulus control with respect to self-control and things like smoking, most people probably aren't going to think about the fact that if you're trying to quit smoking, but you keep walking through the entranceway, you know, outside of which you regularly used to go out and take your cigarette breaks, most people aren't consciously going to go, oh, yeah, that's why I keep having these cravings to smoke. It's just, oh, I suddenly want a cigarette. Okay? So somewhere it gets encoded in there. So these can be techniques that become then utilized in behavioral therapies as well. Here's an interesting one. Study by Kamen, 1957. Trained rats with avoidance learning. So avoidance learning protocol. Then tested after various different retention intervals. And so we take a look at this thing going along here. So, you know, immediately after training, so zero retention interval, performance pretty much 100%. The rats are good. It's not a complicated avoidance task, right? Okay, he's not making it, you know, you must program this computer, find the secret code, extend the ramp over the tank of sharks. I mean, this is not something complicated. It's like, press the lever. Okay, so, yeah, they're doing really well at this. Okay, and then he just lets some time pass, goes to retention intervals, and every, it's every 6 hours, he brings them back and tests them. So what we find here is, you know, after 6 hours, that, you know, they're down to only about 55-60% of the rats make a successful avoidance response. Okay, so I mean, this is our sort of standard, it's looking kind of like our standard forgetting cue, right? Okay, 12 hours, even worse performance, 18 hours, worse performance. Oh, okay, well, okay, 24 hours, pop back up. Performance gets a bit better. Maybe that's just an anomaly, random sort of weird, freaky rat thing that happens. Don't know. Okay, so 30 hours, yeah, worse. Here's, you know, yeah, we're back on track for a forgetting curve. 36, 42, oh, 48. We take a jump. Rats suddenly get better. Huh. And forgetting curves looking good. 72 reoccurrence.
Roughly every 24 hours after training, the rats remember more. A little bit better at performance. Well, the what? What's happening here?
Well, we got these circadian rhythms, we got biological clocks. Okay, there's stuff that happens in your bodies and in rat bodies that works on a particular, fairly regular cycle. Okay, if you're into a schedule, you probably go to sleep at more or less the same time, get up at more or less the same time, eat at more or less, you know, have your breakfast generally at more or less the same time. Now, maybe, you know, students don't or whatnot, but, you know, if you're rats in a lab, you do. You're on a schedule. Okay, so, you know, you get fed between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, for example, in the morning.
the rat's going to take a certain amount of time for its physiology to digest and absorb the nutrients from that. Okay, so all this physiological internal data that's going on inside the rats, these become cues. So let's say that the training occurred, you know, an hour after the rats had their breakfast. Okay? Every 24 hours later, the rats are back in about that same physiological state. They've had their breakfast now. It's like, oh yeah, what was I doing when my tummy felt this full a day ago? I was learning how to avoid getting electric shock. Ba-ba. It's a cue. So cue-dependent learning here comes in. All right, so your own physiology comes in. This is why it's a little bit unfortunate that our final exam is from 3 to 5, you know, not from 10:30 to 12:30, because if it was 10:30 to 12:30, you might be going, what am I usually doing 10:30 to 12:30? Oh yes, listening to the dulcet tones of my professor in this crappy little room they've stuck us in. The crappy little room may even serve as a cue. Well, you know, hopefully the crappy little room, because you're going to be writing in here anyways, a concrete bunker will serve as a little bit of a cue for you. What do I do here? Psychology. How do I do it? Well, okay, work on that. Tell yourself that, okay? What am I going to get? High grade. Okay, go with that. Okay, so this is called state-dependent learning. So the physiological state that you're in actually serves as a context cue for a behavior. Now, in the case of Cayman's rats, it was like their own internal physiology from like when they were sleeping, when they were eating, all of these sorts of things. With humans, right, you can get a similar stuff. I mean, if you've got a schedule, you pound down your 5 days a week if you're out there in the job force, and 5 days a week you got the same sort of process, got to be to work by, 8 o'clock, so you're getting up at 6 o'clock, you get showered, shaved, dressed, meal, onto the bus, subway, down to work, boom, boom, boom. You know, if you're really regular like that, you find a lot of people say, oh, but it's weekends, sleep in on the weekends. Yeah. Boom, 6 o'clock, you're awake on the weekend. Total bummer, right? Why? Well, I said, 5 days out of the week, you're on that same schedule. Sixth day, your body goes, what do I do at six? I get up. I'm awake. You don't have to be awake, but I am. Darn. Okay, so hopefully you get great things accomplished, or you just lie there going, I should be sleeping. Why aren't I sleeping? I hate my job. Right? Okay. Anyways, state-dependent learning. Drug conditions can do this, under the presence of certain drugs. These act as a cue for certain things. Some people say going into an exam, oh, if you're going to write an exam, don't drink coffee, don't blah, 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 don't do any, you shouldn't have coffee before then, you shouldn't, don't eat a big meal. Look, my advice is here, whatever you normally do before you come into a class, just do it, right? If you normally have a coffee before going into class, do that. Have it. Somebody was like, oh, it's going to make you totally jittery. You know what? Sure, if instead of having just your regular coffee, it's like, I want nuclear coffee. I want the coffee with the caffeine that would, wake up a rhino. Yeah, sure, you're probably going to get into some issues. If you follow your own pattern, your normal pattern, what the heck? It's probably not, I'm not saying it's going to help you, but at least I can say it's probably not going to hurt you. Okay? So, there is some evidence that you will recall best when you're in the same state as you were in during training. Okay? This has been, in fact, actually utilized in certain court cases. Right? So, witness can't remember something. Take them back to the scene of the crime at the time that it happened. Try to recreate the events up to whenever the crime occurred, okay, in an effort to sort of assist with this. Put them back into that same state. See if that activates any of the memory. Okay. Let's take a look at a few applications here. Foraging.
There are, well, foraging just means you're going to find food. You're foraging for food, for example, or something. Most non-human animals and humans will forage for food at various points. So many of you at the break went off and foraged for something successfully, booster juices, muffins, coffees, water, whatever it happens to be. Some species of animals will actually cache their food. That is, they will store it someplace. If they found food, they will store it for later. So you heard about the case a couple of weeks ago where the escaped murderer shot up with a whole bunch of drugs in a car in BC, killed himself apparently. Bear wanders by, finds this nice pile of meat in a car, yanks the guy's body out through the car window, eats a good deal of them, and then buries piles of leaves and branches and sticks over what's left of the body because he's caching it. He's going to come back and get it later. I can't eat all of this human right now, but it's tasty, kind of like chicken. I'll come back later and eat the rest of them. That's caching. A lot of birds do this. Common birds, anemones, sparrows, chickadees, things that stay through the winter. They'll spend the fall hiding seeds and dried berries and whatnot, little crevices and cracks. My eldest son used to do this when he was a kid, an infant. You know, you'd give him some, you know, hungry, give him cracker or graham cracker or grape or something like that. And we didn't realize it initially, but he wouldn't always eat all of it. So he'd sometimes eat some of it, and then he'd go find someplace to hide the rest. And so, you know, behind the books on the shelf or, you know, under the chair. And, you know, honestly, I didn't really mind too much when it was something like, you know, a cracker or a cookie bit or a little piece of toast or something. This was less good when he was doing this with, like, his milk and his yogurt. And it's like, you smell something? Yeah. What is that? I don't know. Clean the room. I don't know what it is. We'll just more air freshener. Just like, the go! Jeez, it's moving now. Yeah. So anyways, I'm pretty sure we've destroyed new life forms in the yogurt that's been hidden under the sofa for 3 weeks. Food caching. The non-humans, like the sparrows and the chickadees and the blue jays and all these, they actually come back and get the food most of the time. My son would just kind of hide it and leave it there. Sometimes he'd occasionally go back for things like cookies. You know, and it's just like, where'd you get that cookie? Cookie! It's like, yeah, where'd you get it? Cookie! Talking to, you know, a 21-month-old is just, where cookie? Cookie where? Find cookie? Cookie! I'm doing it now. Yeah. So, but it's like, you know, anyways. But that's the idea. You go back and you find the food later. Now, to be able to do that, you have to have this spatial memory. Some people are really good at this. My mother was bad at this. She figures it's a good idea to buy like things like Christmas gifts and birthday gifts and stuff when things are on sale, and then she'll put them away when she needs them. And when I was growing up, she figured she had to hide them because, of course, the kids would go looking for them. And you know, none of the kids in my family actually went looking for our gifts, you know, sort of thing. It's just like, where would be the fun in that? It was a surprise, but she figured she had to hide stuff, except she'd forget where she hid it. And so, you know, you'd get the toy that was cool 3 years ago, you know, and for Chris, it's like, wow, thanks. It's like, the sweater is kind of tight on me. It's like, oh, well, just it'll stretch out. You know, we never look for this stuff. You could just, like, put it on that shelf. Offended her sensibilities. Anyways, so not everyone is as good at retrieval. So that becomes an issue of forgetting. Can you remember or not? No, I mean, in the case of my mother and my son, yeah, he wasn't going to starve to death, and my mother, well, you know, whatever. You know, going to have gifts of some sort to give. Whether or not they're relevant is a different issue. But if you're a blue jay or something, and you're storing food to survive the winter, to be able to get this back, or you're just going to be a dead blue jay. And you get some incredible things, like they may hide, some studies show that jays can hide, you know, maybe up to 1,500 bits of food, and the retrieval success is over 85%. I mean, that's stunning. They're actually remembering where they've hidden, like 1,100, 1,200 seeds. What? I, I'm doing well if I can remember where I've left my keys,
okay?
Let alone 1,200 sets of keys. What would I do with 1,200 keys? I don't know. But my point is, some species are specifically adapted for this. There's a biological predisposition there. So if you have problems finding your keys or things, you should probably get a pet blue jay and condition it to know where your keys are at all times. Yeah. So a lot of species. So it's an issue of spatial. We'll get into some interesting spatial memory there. Eyewitness. Let's move out of blue jays and stuff and back to humans. Eyewitness testimony. Beloved by court dramas, you know, television shows, movies. The eyewitness shows up and gives evidence, and the bad guy goes to jail. Here's the truth. Eyewitness testimony is generally pretty poor. It's not great. Okay? Most people, I mean, there's a few reasons for this. So, a couple of years back we had, open the door and there's a police officer standing there and it's like, uh-oh, what did I do? You know, he's had that little bit of, sort of thing. It's just like, sorry, we're just checking your neighbor's house across the alley was broken into. Wanted to know if you noticed anything suspicious recently. Like, how recently? Well, she's just gotten back from being away on vacation for 3 weeks, so anytime in the last 3 weeks. Which house? The one. Through my house at the back, sort of kitty corner across the alley that you can barely see because of your tree. By suspicious, you mean like somebody who looked like they were up to no good, hanging around, possibly wearing a hoodie or a balaclava or carrying, say, like the ladder to break in? Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, no, I don't remember anything like that. It's like possibly up to 3 weeks ago, something, but he's like, okay. But what if it's like I just recently seen some, you know, CSI. Well, there's like 6,000 CSI, whatever. CSI, Red Deer, you know, program where, yes, one of their perps broke into something using a ladder. Okay? It's like something suspicious. It's a home break-in. For a reason. You know, I've got this recent show in memory. I think I saw somebody with a ladder. Yeah, you could use a ladder to break into a house. False memory. Did I really see a person break into this house with a ladder? No. Okay. So there's a time delay. These time delays can be a real problem for eyewitness testimony. Issues of proactive interference, stuff you saw in other programs. Here's becoming a big thing as well. A lot of these television programs and movies are becoming like so realistic, right? And that's the whole point, right? They're trying to do reality style, you know, dramas. They're recreating these in a realistic seeming kind of way. This is leading to more and more cases of mistaken memories. If it seems like something you may have seen, your brain drags out a memory of that. It's like, yeah, I think I saw that. Here's another one. People don't actually even pay that much attention to most stuff. If you don't know that a specific thing just happened, you know, it's like, go canvas the neighborhood. See if anyone saw anything. If you're not being specifically primed, did anyone see a white sedan drive through the neighborhood? I don't know. I see a lot of cars, right? Now, you know, if it's a white sedan with people hanging out the door shooting at a black sedan, chasing them, it's like, yeah, you might remember that specifically, okay? But these kinds of things are difficult. Eyewitness testimony is problematic. There's often a long time delay between when you may observe something and when you're asked to recall it. So we've just got a long retention interval quite often. A friend of mine got brought all the way back from Australia. He was doing his PhD in Australia. He got brought back because, yeah, he witnessed someone get hit by a car in downtown Edmonton 3 years earlier. I was off doing his PhD in Australia, but the prosecution needed his, figured they needed him there, so he's flown all the way back. He's flown back for like 2 days. It's like one day to fly in, testify, the next day to fly back out. So, I mean, his plane trip cost something like, with this kind of turnaround, $8,000 of plane trip. And basically, he went up, sat on the stand, and they said, "Is this your testimony that you filled out at the time with the police officer?" It's like, "Is this your signature on the bottom?" "Yeah." "Good enough, thank you." "Seriously? That was it?" "Yeah." He said it was good because he couldn't actually remember what happened 3 years later. If he hadn't had his witness statement there that he filled out at the time, he'd have no memory of this. Okay. So, there's other things that can happen with eyewitness testimony. Besides just a retention interval issue, the way the questions are actually asked or posed to a witness can be influential in what they remember. Classic study by Loftus and Zani from 1975. They had their subjects watch a film of an automobile collision. Okay? Then they asked the subjects, "Did you see," and for half the subjects they asked, "Did you see the broken headlight?" The other half of the subjects were asked, "Did you see a broken headlight?" The subjects that were asked, "Did you see the broken headlight?" were twice as likely as the subjects said that were asked, "Did you see a broken headlight?" to say, "Yes, yes, I did." There were no broken headlights in the making of this collision. No headlight broke. But this has to do with past reinforcement history and the learning of what words mean. "The" is a definite article. It implies a presence. "Did you see the big pink elephant just run through the roof?" As opposed to, "Did you see a big pink elephant just run through the room?" It's like, if I say "the," it's like I'm implying there was a big pink elephant that just went through. "Did you catch it?" If I say, "Did anyone see a big pink elephant?" it's like, anybody at all? Because if you did, you're crazy and we need to get you locked up. Right? It's like, A means maybe there was, maybe there wasn't. "Did you see the Batman?"
"I am Batman."
Right? "Did you see the Batman?" "Did you see a Batman?" "Hello, I study bats. I'm a Batman." Right? I mean, totally different. Okay? Now, here's the thing. Lawyers know about this study, right? And if you got something to stand, lawyers can pick their words very carefully. Good lawyers will do this. They will pick their words very carefully to get people to increase the chance that the witnesses will say what they want them to say. Things like police officers that are like collecting, going around asking people for witness statements and whatnot, they may not know about this. They may not be particularly careful. They may not be thinking about how you asked a question could influence a response. In fact, a number of police departments, police programs, actually has training on this in terms of essentially data collection from potential witnesses in terms of how you ask a question could make a difference. But a lot don't. And so, if you had a police officer, "Did you see the black van run through the light and then strike another vehicle and drive off?" If the police officer asks that way, as opposed to, "Did you see any vehicles? Did you see a vehicle go through the light?" That's a very different question. So witness testimony can be very biased based upon past experience with language. By the time you're an adult, you generally have a pretty good idea what language. I mean, you may not be consciously thinking of your grammar, your syntax, or structure, but you've just had so much experience with it from exemplars, you basically know what is being asked. Okay, some interesting things there. Finish up here. Can you get better at remembering stuff? Yeah, you can practice. You can get better at improving memory. We talked about overlearning. Practice will increase retention. The more you do things, the more likely you are to remember it. Even if you're not up to overlearning, just the basic acquisition. The more training trials you go through, the more you're going to remember. overlearning takes this another step beyond. Mnemonics, old term, goes back to the Greeks, pre-writing. It might interest you to know, back when writing first started coming in with the Greeks, or was coming into Greeks, some of the Greek philosophers, instructors, teachers were somewhat horrified by this, because everything previously had been done through oral transmission, so students just had to listen to their instructors and remember everything. And it's like, this new papyrus coming in from Egypt. Look what it's doing. Students can now just write things down. They don't have to remember stuff. Anybody use your calendar, daytimer function on this? Man, I love these things. You know, it used to be you had to remember this stuff. Now, my little phone just beeps at me if I'm supposed to be doing something. It's like my little external brain. Nothing. Okay? Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing. You actually had Greek teachers like 3,000 years ago. It's like, writing. In the same way that you've got people now with like, bringing computers into classrooms. Anyways, mnemonics. The idea of mnemonics was that if you weren't going to write things down, you could find better ways of making associations to store things in memory. These are little mental tricks. So one of the most common ways of remembering, say, a list is to take a little phrase or a song or imagine a route that you might walk through a neighborhood and then link up these things you have to remember with specific either places in your imaginary walk through the neighborhood or link them up with a rhyme or song. So, you know, classic roaring. 1, 2, buckle your shoe. 3, 4, knock on the door. 5, 6, pick up sticks. 7, 8, don't be late. Okay, so if I got a little grocery list here, I need eggs, bananas, milk, and tuna. Okay, 1, 2, buckle your shoe. What is that? I need eggs. Okay, so I'm going to visualize a bunch of eggs that have cracked in the shoe that I'm about to put my foot into. Okay? So, 3, 4, knock on the door. Was bananas, right? Okay, I'm visualizing what happens if I take a banana and try to knock on a door with it. I seem to be in a having things smashed today mode, I just realized. 5, 6, pick up sticks. It was milk. I'm going to visualize a glass of milk with like a big swizzle stick that's a stick in it. 7, 8, don't be late. It was tuna. Right, okay, I'm going to imagine a tuna fish coming to a party late and wondering why it's all over. Whatever. Okay, so you get to the store, and it's like, what was it I had to remember? Okay, 1, 2, buckle your shoe. Oh, yeah, that's the broken eggs. I don't know. Broken eggs, I need eggs. It was broken eggs. 3, 4, knock on the door. That's why I'm slamming bananas into the door. 5, 6, pick up sticks, swizzle stick in the milk. I need milk. 7, 8, don't be late. There's the big tuna. I'm visualizing it in a bowler hat. Going, whoa, where'd everyone go at the party? I need tuna. Okay, you know, you can do this. Anyone you sometimes go to restaurants and the wait staff, it's just doesn't bother writing anything down, gets your order right. They're using some form of mnemonic process there. If you're not nice, you mess with them by like getting up and moving around. Because they've probably done it by some sort of directional thing. You know, the person sitting with their back to the fireplace wanted whatever, the chicken, and they visualize, I don't know, a chicken toasting its like feathers in front of the fireplace, having a like buttered rum or something, whatever. If you all move around, it's like, that's cruel. Tip those people better because you're messing with them. All right. So, mnemonics. Or you could do this with, like I said, a path, a walkthrough. You could visualize, you know, a path to the neighborhood. So, you know, if you take a regular sort of walk, it's like, okay, I'm passing the Farron's house, and the eggs are there. There's eggs, the front of their house is covered in eggs. The neighborhood kids threw eggs at their house, whatever. Okay, so you do it that way. Context cues. Okay, you can, if you need to increase your memory, you can do it in specific places. Do specific tasks in specific places. If you study in a particular place. What do I do here? This is my desk. This is the room where I study. That is what I do. This is study place. This is not computer game place. This is not Skype with friends place. This is not, okay? This has a specific task in this particular place. This is the job I do. This is the work I do. Makes it easier to remember. Prompts. Classic movie, It's a Wonderful Life, right? With his uncle there that's always tying it. And he can't remember things, so he's always tying little bits of string onto his, under his fingers. A little bit of string is a prompt. It's like, oh yeah, that string says I'm supposed to go pick somebody up from the train station, whatever it is. Okay? So, you know, prompts, you can do that. You can write yourself a little note. Don't forget what? You might want to remember. You know, some people have an elastic band. You know, put the elastic band on the wrist. You know, it's like, okay, this is to remind me that I have to, say the British Prime Minister, not forget and leave my kid in the pub. Nobody hear about this yesterday? Not a big thing, you know. Too many cars with security and left his 8-year-old daughter in a pub. You know, big deal. She probably just got a pint, was doing fine. But, you know, it's like, yes, must find out where my daughter is. Always a good thing to remember. Okay. So prompts. Prompts can assist with memory as well. Okay. One more here. I'll take a look at this quickly. Just in terms of associations and prompts and whatnot. Opinions on minivans? Are minivans cool? It's okay, you can say no. It's all right. Okay, so we've got an association. Minivans are not cool. Toyota knows this, all right? So what are they doing? They're making associations here. They're giving you some discriminative, some stimulus control, right? They're playing on a music video trope. People make associations. People do this particular musical genre. They got to be cool. They're going to have the cool cars. They've got the cool lifestyle. All of the, okay, it's funny. We've talked about classical conditioning, the use of this in advertising. Come up with something that makes you laugh. You generate a positive association, okay? Set that up with a stimulus control. Now the Toyota van there, the Sienna. Okay, you see this, maybe you'll think it's less uncool. They've taken What about the people that were involved here, right? I mean, we've talked about the use of celebrities or highly attractive models and things. They're pretty average looking folk, okay? Who are they appealing to? They're appealing to the kind of people that are likely to buy a minivan or a Swagger wagon, okay? Right? Families, okay? Average people. Call it a Swagger wagon. Swagger, swag, rich stuff. Bunch of things there. You got your swag, your bling. Okay? So, again, more of the kinds of conditionings and associations that get formed. They're trying to take and turn the Toyota brand in there. I'm not trying to get you to all run out and buy Toyota products. If the Ford had done something with this or Dodge or whoever, but it just fit nicely here for the idea of the associations. So you get a stimulus control. They're trying to set up a stimulus control in this case. They're trying to enhance the memory of it. And that's the big thing. And here's the deal. A lot of people that are going to see this aren't going to be people that currently need to buy a van. But if sometime down the road, it's like, oh yeah, I need Vantage. What kind of van do you get? What do you remember? What made you laugh before? Toyota, the Swagger wagon, okay? Establishing brand loyalty. Cigarettes. Think about this with cigarettes. Why have something like, remember Joe Camel? You may or may not remember Joe Camel. He's been banned for a number of years, but back in the 80s, there was a cartoon character called Joe Camel. Cartoon camel that smoked. Is this likely to make adults go, hot damn, I want to buy cigarettes from a camel? Who thinks cartoon camels are probably cool? Kids. Who is Camel directly marketing to? Kids that weren't old enough to be smoking, that probably weren't even old enough to be thinking about smoking, certainly weren't old enough to legally be allowed to be smoking. But you get them hooked on the idea that Joe Camel is cool, Camel cigarettes are cool. Get a bit older, which brand are you going to pick? Camel. Pros and cons for stimulus control that you encounter in the world. All right. Let's see. Chapter 12. Some people said, are we going to do two chapters on the last day? Yeah, we are, because chapter 12 is barely a chapter. It's a chapterette. Okay? So, limitations of learning. Learning seems to be great. Taking you through this course, and it's like, wow, learning, super. So much stuff with learning. Yeah, true. Except there are some limitations here. So physical characteristics, right? I can't learn to remember stimuli that are in the ultraviolet range. Tragically, I just do not see into the ultraviolet spectrum. Nor can I learn to see into the infrared spectrum. Snakes can see in the infrared. Bees can see into the ultraviolet. There's differences. There are going to be physiological differences. Insofar, we've seen a bunch of stuff that Pavlov had come up with, and poor Pavlov often seems to be wrong in his theorizing, but he was at least right in this. Different species do have different physiological capabilities. If you lack a physiological capability to detect a stimulus or to make a response, you won't. You can't. Okay? These are the ideas of the biological preparedness. I mean, the preparedness might not entirely prevent an individual or a particular species from engaging in some activity. So, Sheldon trying to get Penny to leap out of a pool and balance a beach ball on her nose, it's not impossible to do this, but it's less likely. It's probably a lot easier to do that with something that already lives in the water, like a seal or a dolphin. So it does place limitations. The other thing here with learning, and there's actually sort of pro and con to this, learned behaviors are not inherited. Now, here's sort of the downside of this. You take this course, wouldn't it be great if, genetically, when you have kids, if the stuff that you learned in Psychology 281 could just be genetically passed on to your kids so they wouldn't have to go through this course? Sweet. But it doesn't work that way. The stuff that you learn doesn't get genetically passed on. The idea that this would happen, the idea that changes that occur during an individual's life become inherited is what's called Lamarckian evolution. Lamarck was another biologist slightly before Charles Darwin here, who thought that the way evolutionary characteristics were carried forward was through acquisition during the lifetime. Now, Lamarck's gotten a lot of bad press about this through, you know, the late 20th century, and it's like, oh, Lamarck was stupid, oh, what a dumb idea, ooh, didn't he know that it was all wrong? To be fair, it wasn't a bad theory at the time, okay? There's been a lot of theories that have been proved wrong. Linus Pauling, generally seen to be a brilliant biochemist, thought that the DNA was probably a triple-stranded DNA. Wrong, but it would have worked in the same way that Lamarck's ideas about the inheritance of acquired characteristics, it's wrong, it would have worked. Pavlov has been wrong on a bunch of stuff, could have worked. That's how science operates. So, you know, we shouldn't really be dissing researchers because they get theories wrong as new evidence appears. Regardless, going back into the early 20th century, a guy called William McDougall suggested that perhaps, in fact, learning could be inherited. What McDougall did was he trained rats on specific tasks, maze running, for many, 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 many generations. And according to his data, he found that the rats across generations were doing better with the mazes. So rats from, say, the 30th generation that had learned how to run this maze were better at running the maze than rats from the first generation. If this were actually true, then yes, this could be some good evidence for the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Unfortunately, no one's really been able to replicate his results. We don't really know exactly why. I mean, there's his result. We've got no reason to suspect that McDougall was lying, that he was fabricating his results. We don't know exactly how he got the data he did. One possibility was that he was inadvertently making selections in terms of which rats he'd breed. He didn't, I mean, rats will breed like, well, bunnies. Again. You know, a rat mom may have a litter of 8 rat pups and may have, like, you know, 6 or so litters during her lifetime. Consequently, even if he only starts with, you know, 100 rats in the first generation, by the 30th generation, he's got 37,900,000,000. He's got a lot of rats, okay? He's not going to breed all of his rats. So he may quite unconsciously have, it's like, who am I going to pick? Who am I going to pick? He might have picked the better rats, the rats that just for whatever reason each generation were a little bit better at the spatial navigation. Now, that could be because these rats, you know, they see him coming to reach into the cage and grab him, and they're better at trying to run and hide. And he thinks, oh, I'm going to get you, and goes after him. I don't know. He didn't write this down, but it's like, oh, rat-catching game. Now, of course, we do that as an app. But, you know, it's like, oh, you're a challenge. You know, what? We don't know. Maybe he was selecting rats that just had a better spatial representation, or who knows. Others that have tried to do this under very controlled situations where selection of which rats get to breed is completely randomly determined haven't been able to replicate his results. Okay? It seems that, in fact, no. If you just randomly select by generation 30, they're not doing any better than they were at generation 1. Okay. And, in fact, actually, this makes sense. If, for example, you guys were able to genetically pass on what you learned in Psychology 281 to your kids who have been going to university, let's say you get really busy, even like tonight, and so we're looking at about 19 years from now, your kids are going to show up to us around 20 years, okay? Have to be in the class 281 20 years in the future. And it's like, great, your kids inherit everything that you've learned. I will hope that there has been some progress in the field of learning behavior over the next 20 years. And so, you know, if you actually pass that on, your kids are actually at a deficit. They have to, like, it's like, but I'm quite sure that this thing happens. It's like, oh yeah, we just proved that 15 years ago. Huh? You're blowing my genetically regulated mind. Okay, so in fact, this is actually a good reason for not having the inheritance of learned material, right? Because learning is dealing with these short-term changes. Well, they're short-term. We do know, though, that there are genetic influences on the ability to learn. This isn't the same thing as inherited, inheriting learned behaviors. Though. But we do know that, for example, like spatial ability, just through the wacky randomness of genetics, some individuals may be better at certain kinds of behavioral abilities than others. So Tryon, 1940, published on this for 18 generations, bred rats. He bred the best maze-running rats with the best maze-running rats and the worst maze-running rats with the worst maze-running rats in every generation. After 18 generations, he had some rats that, you know, the best of the best of the best of the best were really good at running mazes. The worst of the worst of the worst would get lost in the start box. Well, okay, not quite that bad, but I mean, didn't do well. So, you know, there are abilities. If we took, you know, the top people in this class that did the best in this class and bred them together and then continued this for 18 generations, it's highly unethical, all right? But it's probably no worse of a way of finding mates than eHarmony. So, you know, whatever. But, you know, you could do the same sort of thing. Studies done with identical twins, you know, raised together, raised apart. It's really, sure, there is a certain genetic component to abilities, but environment also comes in. We've talked about whether or not you give, you know, rat pups access to rat toys or not. You know, like the little cardboard tubes or wheels to run on or enriched environments, those sorts of things. The environment can influence this. Some people really just do not have, my eldest son just, you know, yeah, he's going to need to really buy a GPS system for everything. Because my daughter, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to so-and-so's house. You've been there once, like a year ago. I mean, you're right, we are, you know. My son is like, huh? My son is like, okay, let's go, let's get to the car. It's like, okay, down the front path, you know, the walk. Turns the wrong direction. It's like, dude, the car is like right there. Huh? Oh! It's like, dude, that's the wrong side. Your seat's on the other side. Oh! It's like, love them. But I mean, you know, it's just spatial abilities, you know, it's just kind of go. It does well at chess, you know, so he gets spatial things there. But I mean, you know, large scale, it's like, so, you know, should he be an explorer? He could possibly accidentally find something that nobody else would have looked for, kind of like Columbus, but probably not. Okay. So, you know, there are these interesting issues here. Other things that can influence learning, neurological damage. So neurotoxins can have consequences for learning. Prenatal damage to the central nervous system, fetal alcohol syndrome, pregnant moms taking crack cocaine. These can permanently affect the brains of gestating babies. I was actually just doing something with a fetal alcohol kid last night. Oh, nice kid, really nice kid. No impulse control whatsoever. Zero. Well, okay, maybe 3% impulse control. Not his fault. His brains just ended up being wired differently because his mom was an alcoholic while she was carrying him. Lead. Environmental toxins. Right? Lots of them out there that do this, but lead. If you get your water piped to you through lead pipes, you know, this will probably have a bit of a consequence for you. The Franklin Expedition. I'm trying to find the Northwest Passage back in the early 19th century. The Canadian Arctic, they got trapped in ice and everyone died. Anyways, about 25 years ago, the anthropology department here at the U of A went up, and before they all, you know, died trying to hike out of the Arctic to like southern Canada, some of them died on board the ship. It was trapped in ice and they were like buried up in the Arctic. And we still know where like three or four of these graves are. And anthropology department here at the U of A went up and exhumed some of the bodies. Took tissue samples, then reburied them, whatnot. They found that the men that died there had abnormally high levels of lead in their tissues. Now, one of the strange things about the Franklin expedition was the leaders of the expedition, including Franklin, made some very odd, as they got trapped in ice, they thought what would happen was they'd be trapped over winter for 1 year, then the ice would break up, and then they could continue sailing. They hit a particularly cold stretch of weather, and the ice never let up. So they got trapped in ice for over 2 years. Now, what happened was the leaders made some potentially bad decisions. They broke up into different groups, headed off different directions, and actually, really, pretty much none of them were seen again. Well, there was one group that was probably spotted by some Inuit who just went, "Oh, this crazy white guy is doing." All died, okay? But the leaders made bad decisions. And people, even at the time, you know, they found some diaries and other things, like, it's a bad choice. Why would you make such a bad choice? Well, the possibilities are dealing with lead poisoning. Where's the lead coming from? Franklin, using the most up-to-date technology of the time, brought canned food, specifically canned vegetables and fruits, and other things as well were canned, to deal with things like scurvy. One of the things, though, is the technology in the early 19th century for making canned products was to seal the cans with lead. The lead was bleaching into the fruits and vegetables, especially the ones that were more acidic, and essentially the crew was suffering from lead poisoning. Okay, so yes, lead can have a negative consequence on your cognitive abilities. Please, 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 in the next 2 days before the final exam, do not get a lead lollipop. All right, thank you. Physical damage, concussions. In the news right now with NFL, former football players. There's been several that have committed suicide recently, found dead. Lawsuit coming here about the idea that the NFL knew the consequences of repeated concussions in terms of cognitive abilities, depression, and massive lawsuit. We'll see how that one goes on this one. But yeah, concussions. What's happening in concussion? Your brain is actually smacking against the inside of your skull. Every time your brain smacks against the inside of your skull, a few of those nerve cells die. Try to avoid concussions. Critical periods. These are optimal stages for learning. Conrad Lorenz demonstrated this in terms of imprinting. So Lorenz did this classic study where he raised he got a bunch of goose eggs. So mother goose has a bunch of eggs. Mother goose gets removed from the equation, possibly eaten, you know. Lorenz keeps the eggs warm, rotates them, and is present when the goslings hatch out of their eggs. Lorenz is the first thing that they see, and he hangs out with these little newborn goslings, feeding them and taking care of them there for the first about 18 hours of life. What he discovers is that the little baby goslings, you know, when he eventually starts walking out, they follow him. They have imprinted on him. They treat him as mother goose. I mean, he doesn't look anything like a goose, but the goslings figure, yeah, it's a big thing walking around that took care of us. It must be a goose. That's mom. It's like famous photographs of him like walking out into a pond on his farm and all the goslings swimming out behind him. Sort of thing. So imprinting. Children. If children are kept isolated and not exposed to language, hearing language, if this happens through, say, the first 6 to 8 years of life, they'll have a very hard time acquiring language. It's not that they can't, but they're never going to be like native speakers. There's also other issues there. You get into autistic-like behaviors in many cases as well if they're isolated. There's critical periods. Seen in puppy dogs as well. Puppy dogs at about between 6 to 8 weeks of age. 7 to 9 weeks of age. Dogs have an innate increased sensitivity at this point. In other words, they get scared of things. The puppies get scared of things more easily. This is also at just about the same time that puppy dogs start to be able to walk around a bit. Okay, so they're getting a bit further away from mom. Sensitivity to possible things that could hurt them is good. What happens now that we have domesticated dogs, what happens at about 7 to 9 weeks of age? That's when most people go and take their puppy from mom, take it home. People go, oh, I don't understand why my dog is afraid of the vet, is afraid of the car, is afraid of loud noise. Why? Because you've just taken this puppy, punked it into, you know, a car. You know, taken her to the vet, getting shots and being picked up, put in the cold. All this stuff happens when they're most sensitive to generating fearful responses to novel behaviors. People want their puppies early. They're so cute. Okay? Critical periods. Classic study by the Harlows, 50s and 60s, about the rhesus monkeys, with the terry cloth monkey moms. So wire mesh rack that the monkeys could get milk from, little milk bottle and stuff. They found those monkeys that were just raised, that just had their basic needs met, did not engage socially with other monkeys. If they did have babies, they couldn't raise them. Took and wrapped up the little wireframe monkey mom, artificial monkey mom, with like terry cloth. These monkeys would like clutch onto it, would hang onto it, would like cuddle with it. Did better. They were still not great parents, but they did better. So again, critical periods, very important in learning. We talked a little bit about biological preparedness. These are how species-specific behaviors will influence what can be learned, how behaviors are performed. These basically then are genetic predispositions. They will either assist or hinder the acquisition of behavior and also the retention of behavior, right? Like the caching in birds. Birds that cache food are great at remembering where they've hidden the food. They may not be great at other stuff, but they're really good at that. Now, an interesting discovery with respect to this was found by accident. It's called instinctive drift. Discovered by Breland and Breland, published in 1961. Breland and Breland were two of B.F. Skinner's graduate students. They decided, though, they weren't going to go on for the PhDs. They weren't going to go on and try to work in academia. They took what they learned from Skinner, their graduate work, and started working in, Hollywood, with television shows, movies. They had a company that would train animals for movie shows, for commercials, things like this. They got a contract with a bank. And the bank said, you know, animals are cute. We think if we can get animals to do cute things, people will like our bank and will come to it. Okay, basic idea, cute animals, the U.S., you know, the bank name, the CS. Okay, so we've talked about this. They said, Breland, come up with something. It's like, okay, here's an idea. We'll get a pig, see? We'll get a pig, and we'll make a big wooden coin. Okay, so we'll get the pig to pick up the coin and take it over to a piggy bank. Get it? Piggy bank. And we'll put the logo of your bank on the piggy bank, and the pig will drop the coin into the piggy bank. So, right, it's like banking at the piggy bank. It's like, yes, we like it. Do it. Okay, so they start doing this. Basic, they think this should be easy. Basic operant conditioning task, right? They start shaping the pig. If the pig looks towards the coin, they give it some food. If it takes a step towards the wooden coin, they give it some food. If it touches the coin, they give it some food. If it picks the coin up in its mouth, they give it some food. If it takes a step towards the piggy bank, they give it some food. Okay, this has been going okay up to about here, but then something weird starts happening with the pigs. The pig starts like going over, picking up the coin, taking a step towards the piggy bank, and then flips the coin up in the air, drops on the ground, stomps up and down on it. You know, or will just walk a little bit and start just like chewing the coin apart and then stomping on it some more. And by the time they get the pig over to the piggy bank, they've quite often just got this ratty piece of like wooden crap that doesn't look anything like a coin at all. You know, the bank advertising executive is like, right. See, now we know you're academics and maybe you don't get this, but we don't want our bank clients to come to our bank and like eat the money in front of us. And it's like, yes, we get, you know, Breland's like, yes, we understand that, thank you. We do understand how money works, yes. Eating money is not, okay. It's like, right, this isn't working. They can't get the pig to really do it. It's like, bank guy's going, well, what else you got? It's like, raccoon? Yeah, raccoon, right, raccoons. They got the little masks, they're like bandits. This will be great, right? So we'll get the raccoon. A raccoon will take a coin, it's going to be even better. Okay, we'll get the raccoon to carry the coin over to, and the bank guy goes, a raccoon bank? Such things. No, we'll make like a little steel safe and put your logo on it and it'll be banking. It was like, oh, okay. Same sort of thing. The raccoon looks at the coin and gets some food if it takes, okay. Da 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 da. The shaping. This actually is going better. The raccoon takes the coin over to the little safe, drops the coin into the safe, then reaches back in, takes it out. Rubs it, drops it back in, takes it out, rubs it, drops it. It's like the bank guy's going, okay, so let me explain how banks make money. It's like, duh, begins going, it's like, just shut up. See, they make money by leaving the money with us, and we invest it. We want people to put the money in the bank and not take it back. It's like, yes, we get it. Didn't work. Didn't work at all. They were never able to develop these commercials. They did eventually do a commercial with a pig wearing a chef's hat, pushing a small shopping cart through a supermarket and buying pork. Which is somewhat questionable because we have a cannibalistic pig now. Okay, so what we see here is early on in training, the subjects are doing fine. The shade thing is working. Later in training, they get into a problem. Now, if you know anything about pigs and raccoons, pigs will... pigs eat a lot of tough, fibrous food. So they will stomp on it. They will chew on it. They will break it up until it's easier to digest. It's called pre-digestive breakdown of the food. Raccoons, they'll find things. They'll take it over to a stream or to water, and they'll rub it off. Like if they've got a crayfish, this rubbing action breaks up the shell of the crayfish so they can eat the inside soft, yummy bits. Breland and Breland described this as instinctive drift. What was happening was the animal's behavior was drifting towards their instinctive food-related behavior. Why? Well, we've got an association being made. What are they reinforcing the subjects with during shaping? With food. You see the coin, you get some food. You touch the coin, you get some food. You pick the coin up, you get some food. What association have we got here? CS food. Coin, CS food. Coin, food. Coin is food. What do you do with food if you're a pig or a raccoon? Your innate behaviors. So instinctive drift is a case where things can start off fairly well, but you might end up activating these biological predispositions. Similar to this, one called auto-shaping. Now this one is actually figured out on purpose by Brown and Jenkins. In Brown and Jenkins, they had pigeons key pecking. They put pigeons on a variable time 60-second grain delivery. Now remember, with variable time, you don't have to do anything. The food will just be presented. What they did was 8 seconds before the food would be delivered, they turned on a light. Okay. No response is necessary. What they find is the pigeons start pecking the light. Usually after 100 or 150 trials, the pigeons just go and start bop, 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 bop on the light. Here's the cool thing. So I said, oh, we've automatically shaped the pigeon auto-shaping to key press. Okay. Here's the cool thing. Again, same idea of instinctive, a little bit of the instinctive drift, the association predisposition. If pigeons eat grain, they hold their beak in an open position. So boom, 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 they eat the grain. If they drink water, they hold their beak in a closed position, kind of like a straw. The pigeons were pecking the key with an open beak. When they shifted and had water-deprived pigeons, the pigeons pecked the key with a closed beak. The light, the key light, came to take on the properties of what they were getting. And this makes sense. In the real world, if you see something that, you know, if you learn cues that this is food, it probably is food. If you see someone says, yeah, this is drink, it is the drink. In the real world, it's not like, yes, this thing here is a voucher that you can turn in for 6 grams of food. People do weird stuff like that, right? This is a gift certificate to go get food. In the real world, if it's food, it is food. Right? So the biological predispositions. Okay. Anyways, that concludes, you know, the learning of behavior song and dance show. Final exam, 100 questions about. Two-thirds of the questions, well, probably about 60%, something like that, you know, about roughly two-thirds, are going to be post-midterm. Like I said back at the beginning, we haven't, you know, had, some people would give you a final, you know, a second midterm on the last day of class, a second midterm. That's like a final term, whatever. Okay, so it'll be weighted towards stuff post-midterm, but obviously you still need to know other stuff. Basic principles have gone throughout the course there. Same basic type of questions there, four answer, multiple choice. Same advice that I gave you. If you don't know the answer, if you're spending too much time, go on.
move on to another question, come back to it. Worst comes to worst, guess. If you're not sure, try to at least eliminate two distractors, right? Try to get rid of at least a couple of things. Hey, then if you have to guess, you're doing one in two as opposed to one in four, okay? You know, get some sleep. Don't study all night. You'll probably, you know, come in, fall asleep on your desk. Okay. Nothing is meant to be a trick. There may be difficult questions, but nothing is meant specifically to trick you. If you think it's a trick, take a look at the question again. Everything, you should know this, you've encountered this. A lot of the questions are applied questions, or can you take what you've learned and work it in the situation here? There are a few that are, you have to know terms or some details, but the majority of them are going to be more, can we apply this? Can we think about how this uses? Can we see the connections? Okay, if people want to take a look at their midterms, I'll put the stuff back up here. I'll put the key back up again. I'll be here until a bit after, I'll be here until about 2. I've also got your assignments to return, so I will take and put these out on the benches outside. I'll put the key up this afternoon for the 4th assignments. Okay?